Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mudiwa Gavaza, and for today, we're looking at what's happening with our neighboring countries in terms of the economy. You know, every Friday, we like looking at the hard economics news. But for today, we decided that, you know, we need to just peer across the borders to see how South Africa's neighbors have been doing. And to help us to unpack some of these issues, we are joined by Daniel Kavishe, who is from RMB, that is Rand Merchant Bank. He is a sub-Saharan Africa economist. Daniel, greetings to you.
Thank you so much for having me, Mudu. I'm looking forward to our chat.
I'm also looking forward to it, especially because I think sometimes we get into a bit of an echo chamber just around the issues that, you know, plaguing South Africa, the recovery, the pandemic, you know, all of these issues. But from your, I guess, high level and also your purview, you know, what are you seeing in terms of what's going on with our neighbors in the SADC region?
So, you know, the broad themes that we came with into this year seem to be playing out. So I'm going to do a couple of things to just bear in mind. We're pretty much entering 2021, wrapping up our first quarter. And top of mind for a lot of us is a vaccination rollout across the continent and the subsequent impact that would have on the pace of our economic recovery. So that is pretty much a stickler for everyone. Secondly, we're trying to understand what will actually happen with respect to a lot of our governments. They absorbed a lot of debt during the course of last year in the name of fiscal stimulus that they needed to do and financing our way out of this problem, so to speak. And so now that, you know, I don't want to say the dust has settled, but we've entered a year where there's at least a semblance of growth around the corner. We're quite excited at starting to really reopen our economies and get into a sense of new normal when it comes to work, what will actually pan out for a lot of our governments. And so we've been running with these themes at top of mind, sort of your government fiscal state, at the same time looking at how the vaccination rollout plays out as two anchors to help us unpack what's going on in the rest of the region. And just starting off there, if you look at a market such as Mozambique, right? So we saw a government that towards the end of last year had a very firm discussion and decision that they made within cabinet, and you can see it as well within their budget, to maintain spending entering 2021. And they're doing this to support the extent in which COVID-19 has really wrought havoc across the economy. Secondly, as you're well aware, an environment like Mozambique has had to deal with Cyclone Eloise at a time when it was still recovering from two previous cyclones 2 years ago. So this theme of government spending then needs to be colored in the sense that if they're going to continue spending, how does their debt numbers look like? And we're finding for a place like Mozambique that they are in a situation where they're trying to contain that to the best of their ability by sourcing funding internationally, either through the catastrophe framework that they got just after the pandemic, and looking at some of the money they needed to tap into to deal as well with the cyclone. But at the same time, having this discussion of trying to raise funding to deal with the budget deficits that they have also domestically. It seems like the conversation is heavy government, but it's so critical for us to understand that our governments are such key players in our economies, right? We don't have this massive private sector, as you're finding in places like South Africa, that can operate almost agnostic to what's taking place within the government center. The rest of the region, there's a strong reliance for government as your core distributor across the economy. The government multipliers through the infrastructure spend that they have is also critical to understand how these economies pan out. So I think that's been playing out quite well in Mozambique. At the same time, it's also been playing well in Namibia. They just released their budget, as you saw earlier this week. And what we're finding for them is they're starting to have a sense of consolidating, because as soon as they released their budget yesterday, they released their economic recovery plan. And they're taking the approach of, look, We've tried to support the economy to the best of our ability last year. We're looking to offer a tad bit more support this year, next year, but the type of funding we really want to focus on is trying to get the private sector involved. And this is through PPP's involvement, trying to change the operating environment to the best of the ability to draw in investor funding. And, you know, in both markets, what's becoming abundantly clear is over the next few years, there are key sectors we need to focus on. We need to get them going as quickly as humanely possible. I'll chat around what these sectors are in a bit. And this year, they cannot delay. Execution is absolutely top of mind.
Now, Daniel, as you're talking, one of the things that's really coming to mind is, like you said, in these other countries, the government's response is perhaps top of mind because I guess the private sector doesn't have as much capacity as we would have seen in, let's say, South Africa, as you're pointing out. So from that point of view, when I guess looking at budgetary commitments and all of that, how do you, I guess, compare and contrast their level of spending when it comes to vaccination or any other type of social spending that's being done in the name of, you know, protecting, you know, populations, COVID-19, any possible job losses? Has it been as bad in the countries that you've just mentioned? Have those countries' fiscuses experienced as much of a burden as we've seen in South Africa?
Yeah, no, look, I think everyone is, and so this is so key, and I'm glad you brought it up. Firstly, we need to just get into the mindset that there's been a commensurate increase across most of our economies with respect to spending. Now, if I take a sort of a broader view across the region, I mean, an economy like Botswana was probably one of the few ones that entered this crisis with such sizable cash reserves that they could weather most of the storm without necessarily relying purely on getting debt funding. That was not the experience for most of these markets I've mentioned. And we'll also spend a bit of time later talking through particular environment like Zambia, which is, you know, somewhat extreme vis-a-vis sort of your Namibia and Mozambique. So to your point, you know, they've had to absorb, issue debt domestically, you know, have discussions with their international partners, like through the Paris Club, to get some form of debt suspension. And then they have channeled this funding to social sectors. So you're absolutely right. We've saw a massive increase in areas such as health. But the things that most of us don't realize is that they've had to then focus on things like education, right? So our school systems were completely disrupted. The view in which we had of teaching has completely changed. And we know governments have naturally been a strong provider around that. And then, of course, your subsidies and social grants are a big portion of their government expenditure in any case. Your tough one. It's a tough one. You mentioned something now just to do with unemployment and how it's increased. Let me just put it in context. We don't have full unemployment numbers coming out of both of our markets. What we have is a lot of suspicion as to how bad the case has been. What we do have is with the larger economies that have been reporting the unemployment figures, some indication as to how, you know, difficult the market has been. And if I think about the release that came out about a week ago, and this is more Northern Africa, looking at what is taking place in Nigeria, unemployment rate has pretty much declined, or unemployment has worsened to over 33% from sub 28, 27. So if we say there's a 5% increase, and Namibia's unemployment rate just on that note was already hovering at about 34, if not 33. So it's potentially closer to 38%. This is massive, right? These are small economies, Mozambique, Namibia, both economies just the size of about, give or take, Namibia is pretty much the size of, I would say, more or less trying to just convert that. So it's about 180 Namibian dollars, right? Depending on what exchange rate you're using, you know, so then that will give you a dollar equivalent, which, you know, could hover anywhere between, you know, sort of your 10 billion, right? So these are not big economies. Mozambique, a bit bigger, it's about 15 billion, right? So, you know, you have massive employment increase in this markets, and that makes it abundantly difficult. Because government then is forced to figure out a way in which right? This is a difficult million-dollar question. How are you going to try and consolidate your budget, contain operational expenditure, when you're also the key employer, right? And then your private sector has lost jobs. So the recourse that then makes sense is to figure out how are you going to drive in foreign funding, potentially, or create such a good environment such that your own domestic corporates reinvest in an economy, because over the past year, they've been pretty much shedding jobs, trying to operate as lean as possible. And this is, you know, a very difficult balance that our governments are facing, Mudia.
One of the things that I think maybe needs to be unpacked a little bit more from what you're saying is maybe getting an understanding of what the lockdowns actually looked like in each one of these countries. I think, previously we had your colleague Neville, and he described what the lockdowns looked like, in more of the northern and western African countries. And I don't think we really got to appreciate what was happening, right next door, because we were so concerned about our own lockdown in South Africa, sometimes you look at what's happening inside your own house without actually looking at what's happening across the street.
Yeah. So a couple of things there. To start off, your Namibia, Zambia, they had hard lockdowns they had to institute. That goes without saying. You can extend that even to Botswana. And that meant, the same type of levels that South Africa had to experience were experienced there as well. Mozambique was in a bit of a tricky and difficult situation. The first things you need to understand for Moz is during the crisis, they were trying to rebuild from the cyclones that had taken place 2 years ago. So yeah. You had a lot of infrastructure and construction spend already taking place, right? That's the first thing. Then Mozambique is one of those markets where you still have a sizable rural population, and you also have got a very spaced out economy. And what I mean by this is, one province will look particularly different from another depending on where it is you sit. And so separating activities that are taking place in Maputo with activities that are taking place in areas like Cabo Delgado, in your mind, you could almost think they're two separate economies with respect to the speed. So Mozambique enters this crisis. They have a general state of emergency, and then they start introducing lockdowns. But, the sense on the ground was that they were not to the same gravitas as what we saw in South Africa or in Namibia. And I think this just had to do more it had to do more with the nature of the economy and structurally how it's built vis-a-vis intention of, having a hard lockdown. And I think we need to separate that. And then, of course, there were periods in time or areas within Mozambique as well where, that sort of sense of a hard lockdown was experienced. But, the economic numbers never lie. And it was quite interesting to pick up during the course of last year that you could still see activity in sectors such as agri, construction, which, because I couldn't physically travel there and see some of these markets that we cover, you could tell that, with discussions with guys locally, some business still continued. So that just helps to put things in context. And you bring that up because then it justifies, A, why the governments responded to that. But then also it tells us why, Mozambique was quite, expedient in ensuring that it got vaccines quite early. So, amongst us, the countries I'm talking about now, Mozambique was first to have, vaccines within its within the medical field. And they already started rolling that out to their health workers, right? Namibia's vaccines, as you're well aware, only arrived during the course of this week. Zambia, we're still not sure when vaccines will arrive in that market. And I do think the approach Mozambique took was because they were well aware there was still some activity taking place in this market. And I think it made sense for them to ensure that they got vaccines as quickly as possible and to deal just with the structure of the economy.
And then something that I think would be good to touch on is that there are corporates in South Africa that do have operations in those countries. And my understanding is that, people like yourselves do advise, some of these corporates, because there are all of these considerations to make. How do you go forward? All of that. And you've just come from describing the different approaches that the countries took in terms of their lockdowns. And it sounds like, you know, some of them were quite in line with what was going on, in South Africa. But on the vaccine front, things have been a bit different in terms of how they're sourcing and actually rolling things out from that point. So for corporates that do have those businesses, how have you seen, I guess, the appetite? Are people really keeping up some of those operations that they have in those countries? Or did we see any closures? Or are people still choosing to say, okay, fine, I need to maintain my presence in those countries?
So we saw retrenchments, but not closures per se. Investing, the type of clients I deal with are your larger sort of corporate entities. They're making a judgment call for a market when they invest in, not to do with just the current economic conditions. They make a 5-year, or 10-year, 15-year view on a market, then they go in, right? So you think about your large retailers, your large distributors, your large wholesale players, your miners, etc. They're not transitory in the way in which they're thinking, sort of like your bond investors who can sort of come in and come out on your financial markets. And so what we found was that they basically just try to make their operations across the region cost efficient. And so it was almost natural that during the course of last year, we heard of a lot of retrenchments. The other thing, of course, was that they had to then rely that the support that they have given to the businesses in the various markets, that, you know, the managers in these markets will be able to take the rein and do what's best in that given economy, because, you know, you can't offer the same nature of or direct support that you could have done from previous years when you could easily travel. And then, you know, you touched on this. We focused on lockdowns, but we need to remember that there was complete and utter disruption at our borders. So moving product across the region pretty much slowed down. And, you know, quick questions I've been getting is, you know, now that sort of borders have reopened, how's that looking? And you can imagine with you, it's very intuitive, right? So borders reopen, guys are starting to move product again. Let's just use that SA as a benchmark, from SA, let's say, to Mozambique. And prices, of course, then have ticked up, right? So oil was down last year, now it's increased in price. You've had supply constraints, which is pretty much definition of economics. The reason why prices go up is because of supply constraints. We had that playing out. So now we're entering this environment where across our different markets, the corporate entities have slimmed down. They're operating in a little bit of a firmer base, as lean as they can, but then facing the fact that their product has become more expensive in an environment where demand hasn't necessarily increased, all to do with some of these supply constraints. And these impacts are not, it's stuff we're going to be talking about during the course of this year. And I promise you, it's stuff we're going to be talking about next year. It takes a while for this to normalize. It takes a while for us to adjust. Everyone keeps talking about going back to pre-pandemic levels. You know, just from a quantitative basis and looking at the numbers, it'll take us about 2 to 3 to 4 years, depending on which market you look at, to get to the same type of output that we had pre-pandemic. So let that just sink in. 3 to 4 years before you get that true bounce back in the size of the economy. So no, we're not going back to pre-pandemic levels. We are going into a completely different economic structure. That's what we should focus on. Because just trying to go back to how things looked like, you are forgetting that there's been a massive change in your IT sectors and in some of your other industries, which have had to improve. And so people are thinking very differently about operating in these markets vis-a-vis others. But coming back to your questions, A, these corporates, yes, they had to slim down. And then I mentioned at the beginning that the big effect was retrenchments. What then we're also seeing from the laborers is this new wave of having multiple jobs if possible. Right. So you cannot rely on one form of salary. I think we've been talking about that for a few years. Now it's almost certain. Case in point, tourism. Right. So you've got very few hours that you can actually go into your current operation. The guys have been forced to start up businesses and do other things to get funding. I hope that helps.
No, it certainly does, and it's quite sobering. Every time I hear these figures, it's not the first time that we've heard about how long it would take for, you know, our various economies to claw back the losses of the pandemic and just go back to where they were just before the pandemic, before we can really say that there's been actual growth in, you know, in the various economies. It's always very sobering to hear that thought. And it never, I don't know how else to say that it never gets old. It's always so surprising and so shocking when you actually think about, you know, how much distance has been traveled. But I like the fact that you do tell us that, guys, we're not going into the same, you know, structure that we were coming from. Especially what you've just said now about people having, you know, multiple roles. I know that, you know, they're probably your competitors, but I was reading something from Old Mutual the other day that said that 25% of South Africans are now participating in the gig economy in one way or another, you know, because they simply can't rely on, you know, one stream of income or one job, because it's either unsecure or that one job doesn't pay enough. So I guess going forward, that then begs the question of, you know, where do you sort of see things in the region going? And the reason I'm asking is because, you know, the last couple of months in the year has also coincided with the start of the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement and all of that stuff. Should we even be concerned about all of this regional integration? Is it going to help us? Are people going to rather focus inwards and say we need to rebuild inside before we can look outside? Because I think at the end of the day, especially in the SADC region, there's just, you mentioned the borders just now, there's just always been this interconnectivity between the various economies.
So just a couple of thoughts around that. We'll do a quick guess from you. How many daily doses do you think we're doing for a vaccine, based on what you'll see?
I would estimate, 40,000 a day. I would hope 40,000 a day.
We would all hope, right? So I want to start here because this is the core problem I'm having. And just to add on to that narrative with respect to how economies look like, we are doing under 20,000, right? Daily. Best, and this is in good markets, right? SA, I think there was a time they were just averaging just over 10,000. If we continue at current rates, right, it'll take extremely long. And let's not even talk numbers. Some guys are giving estimates that we'll be dealing with this for the next 20 years. But one thing we know for certain is that in order for us to have herd immunity in 2 to 3 years' time, we will need to be doing about 100,000 doses daily. The reason I want to start off by mentioning this is to say that we cannot start talking about a free trade agreement. We cannot start talking about strong economic narrative without dealing with the elephant in the room, that is our vaccination process is still quite slow and it is lagging international markets. Right? So now let's hope that we get this right by June, such that regionally we're doing 100,000 doses daily per country, right? So let's assume we've got that right. What sectors then will we be seeing a lot of economic activity? Because, right, if we get that right and actually increase our daily doses, we decrease the amount of future waves, right? So we've spoken about COVID. We know we're entering a third wave now in 2 to 3 months. It's done, it's settled, we know this. Kenya's already started with their third wave. We can only anticipate that the rest of the region will probably hit third wave as winter beckons. And that means potentially localized restrictions. That means border disruptions. That means slow economic growth. All right. So sort of just let that settle and sink in. Then we start talking about resuscitating economic growth from a sectoral perspective, such that we start, you know, driving some of our bigger vision and goals as an economy, as a continent. And our best guesstimate is that mining sector will be our saving grace, simply because China, US, Europe are all churning, firing at all cylinders. Commodity prices are doing quite well. So our mining sectors are going to do extremely well. And it's good to know that most of our SADC markets have a deep resource That they can benefit from. And then, as you're well aware, agriculture has done also quite well. We've had decent rains. We're extremely grateful for that. So then our agricultural produce does well. Then, as I mentioned earlier, we're spending on infrastructure. We're building stuff. We're taking the Chinese approach to, you know, in sort of invigorate the economy. We're doing a lot of this infrastructure spend. So all of this then brings about some sort of semblance of recovery this year and next year. And now we've become quite interested with the Continental Free Trade Agreement. We've started it this year. What we're hearing from our clients, Madhua, what they're getting from the borders is that potentially when we get to halfway through the year, will we really start seeing some trade flying through? I don't need to lie to you. You've operated in SADC for quite some time. You understand the difficulties that we have at our borders with our current trade SIC codes. So trying to normalize all of that and create sort of an external tariff, but then also try and reduce 70% of our tariffs by June, July, I don't think we'll be there as a continent, given the fact that we only have 35 countries that have fully. So we've got the 53, 54 that have odd sort of signed up to Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement. That one economy is sort of just trying to get its last few things ready. But out of that broader number, the ones that have ratified and have stated are actually ready to operate are about 35 economies. From those 35 economies, we will likely then start seeing a lot of this trade under this new banner being effected. And the hope and prayer is that this takes precedent over what we've seen up to date, which is our economies actually closing up most of their borders, right? And then not protecting some of their industries and actually not allowing for the free movement of goods. What I sort of am more interested in with you is the African passport. That's the one I've gotten my money on, because I'm looking forward to be able to travel across the continent, you know, extremely efficiently, having that as being the first thing, which really should be the easiest to enact. We know from news reports that our diplomats already have these AU passport and they're testing it out. I'm quite curious to get it, of course, because then, you know, that can symbolize free movement of individuals across the continent, which I think is the first step. But I think when it comes to goods, you and I both know that it's quite difficult in terms of just getting these SIC codes. And these are what we call our trading codes for products cross-border. Getting that sorted will take some time.
Guys, Daniel from RMB is just giving us a lot of food for thought and a lot of, you know, sobering realizations about the actual realities that are on the ground when it comes to, you know, our various economies. He's saying that he's looking forward to the AU passport. I'm also looking forward to it, because as someone who's spent many hours standing in home affairs lines, it will be good, you know, to reduce some of the red tape that it takes to just, I guess, move around, you know, our countries. And, you know, the vaccine rollout, like what you're saying, I think it is the main priority. And it's quite shocking that whilst some countries, you know, have been doing, I guess, you know, half a million vaccinations a day, we're barely scraping the 20,000 mark. But let's see what happens. Is there anything that you're actually hopeful about?
So, I mean, the intention was not to come out as being too negative. I think the idea is we just need to have that color. We need to be very conscious, especially during the course of this year, that as we resume activity, remember that you still need to get vaccinated. You still need to make sure that your health environment is top of mind. Being very conscious of that will assist the process of recovery. My hope is, at this stage, looking at the recovery plans that our governments have put in place, and I think I know that there's sizable pressure for them to execute the things that they want to execute. So that actually excites me, because before, you know, our governments would say, yeah, we're going to build renewable energy plants. We're going to focus on securing water infrastructure. Now you realize, wait, that's the thing that's going to drive employment in your economy. That's the project that you need to do so that you don't get into this problem anymore. So I'm excited about execution. I think top of mind for everyone should really just be very cautious as you look into 2021 and 2022, and take the learnings that we've had from a year of being separated from a year of not really having that strong interpersonal relationship. All of this feeds into behavioral economics, and it feeds into how we actually view most of our economies at the same time. So we're hoping that the leakages, and I'm using very strong terms here, but the leakages that we had from our economies, we're hoping that pauses, right? So let's not hear procurement challenges, yada, yada. I don't want to hear stories about, you know, vaccines being sourced through under the table. I think as a continent, we need to get very serious and focused about, you know, ensuring that this recovery is one that is not branded by some of the other corruption cases that have wrought and brought a lot of devastation to our economies. So that's what I'm really hopeful for. Thanks for asking that, Bill.
So that's been us with Daniel Kavishe, who is an R&B economist specializing in sub-Saharan economies. And we're just talking about the state of our neighboring countries, specifically Botswana, Mozambique, and Zambia, looking at how the pandemic has affected these various economies, what they did during the lockdowns, how the governments responded, the burden, you know, on the various, you know, fiscal elements, how governments have taken on social spending. And more importantly, the big theme of today's discussion was around how these various governments and economies are going to be handling and are handling the vaccinations. I have to admit that I don't think I was keeping up as much with the vaccination numbers, but I'm actually quite shocked at the rates at which, you know, the vaccinations are happening. But it is important that those numbers go up so that we can reach the herd immunity and, you know, somehow, you know, have people go back outside so that we can engage, you know, a bit better and actually try by all means to claw back the losses that the pandemic has given to us. So that's been it. Daniel, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Madhua. I really appreciate the time. It has been fantastic.
This is Mudiwa's Take.
Fantastic discussion with Daniel from R&B. And for me, two big things stick out. The first one is what he said at the end when he said he's excited by the fact that, you know, for once, the things that that governments have said that they need to do to give growth and ensure some type of economic recovery, there's a bit more pressure to get those things done. And that also excites me because it literally means that it is make or break, because where we usually see, let's say, politicians, for example, paying lip service to, you know, job creation, economic growth, all of these themes, this is the one time where we can't really afford to have, you know, such a situation, because it is a make or break. People need jobs. People have lost jobs. People need employment. People need to start businesses. People need enabling environments. That's what we need from, you know, the various governments that we're dealing with. Talking about Botswana, Zambia, Mozambique, and, you know, by extension, you know, what's going on in the rest of the SADC region. But the second one is also just around the vaccines. This is a big theme. We've spoken about this since the start of the year. Where are we going? Where are we? How can we improve? And the important thing is that we're going to have some type of you know, strategy just on how do we increase those numbers. But, you know, going forward, one of the big things is seeing how the various governments are going to mandate or not mandate their populations to get vaccinated. Because one of the big debates now is vaccination going to become a requirement for people to work at their jobs, right? If you decide to come back to the office, or if you're, you know, go to a mine, a factory, a farm, wherever it is that you work, is it reasonable for employers to say that you must be vaccinated before you can return to work so that you don't endanger yourself and, more importantly, endanger infecting those around you? At the same time, governments themselves, what are they saying, right? We've heard one or two African leaders saying in no uncertain terms that they aren't going to force people to get vaccinated. But if people don't get vaccinated, they may be left out of certain economic activities. So those are the things that will be interesting to see what type of alignment governments will have around that. And just a quick point, coming back to the employment thing, when you apply for a job, are people going to say that in the same way that we look for a driver's license, are people going to now say that they want you to have a vaccination certificate of some sort? But, you know, the important thing at this point, you know, as we're trying to decide, you know, what those policies are, the important thing is, you know, trying to inoculate as many people as possible so that we do get to a point where we do reach that herd immunity. So that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcasts on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter, where #BDSpotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a Multimedia Live production. So, for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.